Welcome back to Coast AM. So what if I told you there was one thing that could fight disease, clean up oil spills, even help save the energy crisis and the world? Would you believe me? Or would you believe my guest coming up, award-winning mycologist Paul Stamets? Paul has been a dedicated mycologist for over 30 years with a study of mushrooms, and he has discovered and co-authored four new species of mushrooms and pioneered countless techniques in the field of edible and medicinal mushroom cultivation. He's received countless awards, and his mission is to really make a course change in the evolution of this planet using mushrooms. And he has an incredible TED talk, almost 3 million views, called Six Ways Mushrooms Can Save the World. You might want to check that out during the break. We will be right back with Paul Stamets joining me. This is Lisa Gar. You're listening to Coast to Coast AM. So, if I told you there was one thing that could fight disease and clean up oil spills and really be responsible for ecological restoration, and it was the mushroom, would you believe me? Well, my guest, who has won the National Geographic Adventure magazine's Green Innovator Award, he also was named one of Utney Reader's 50 visionaries who are changing the world, is on a mission to change a course in evolution of this planet using mushrooms. Mycologist Paul Stamets is joining me. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Good, Lisa. How are you?
Great to talk with you again. So tell me about early on. I mean, how did you get interested in mushrooms in the beginning? What started you on that path?
Well, I have a twin brother, and I grew up in Ohio, in northern Ohio, on Lake Erie. And when I was about 5 years old, is my earliest memory of mushrooms. And puffballs would come up in the summertime, and they would explode if you threw them, with little brown spores that would burst out of the mushrooms. And so I was pelting my twin brother with puffballs, and my mother came out and saw us and said, "Don't throw puffballs at your brother. If the spores get into his eyes, he'll become blind." Well, I basically thought to myself, "Thank you, Mom," and I pelted my twin brother with as many puffballs as possible. Because I was always attracted to that which has been forbidden, and so mushrooms are the forbidden fruit. There's a lot of mycophobia, a fear of mushrooms, and it's not surprising because something that can feed you, that can kill you, that can heal you, that can get you high, but are so ephemeral, they come up and disappear in just a few days, whereas most plants and animals are in our viewscape for months or years. So our experiential knowledge and contact with plants and animals is much more extensive than that with these mushrooms that suddenly pop up and then are gone in a few days. So it's a very eclectic knowledge base for
Mysterious,
those people who know mushrooms.
yes, very mysterious. The TED Talk I referenced earlier about six ways mushrooms can save the world, almost 3 million views now. I recently looked at that. You said that most of us may not know that fungi were the first organisms to come to land 1.3 billion years ago, and then plants followed. How did you discover that?
Well, actually, a lot of other scientists have been able to track this. It looks like life first marched onto land, basically from tidal pools or freshwater, ponds and lakes, and fungi associated with cyanobacter and algae. And they first came onto land, and plants very quickly learned, so to speak, that fungi would give them minerals. And so a mutualistic relationship was set up. And then plants per se marched on the land about 450 million years ago. So it took a long time, and these plants became in a relationship that is called mycorrhizal, and that means that the roots of the plant are coated with mycelium, and the mycelium then harvests minerals, and the plants reward the mycelium with sugars. So it's a mutualistic, beneficial relationship, and then as these as plants and fungi evolve, they begin to develop guilds of microorganisms and other communities. So It really shows that fungi are the vanguard species. These are keystone species that come into habitats first. And in the process of their growth, they create downstream nutrient pathways that help all sorts of other organisms. So many of the most common mushrooms that we find in the stores, for instance, like oyster mushrooms and shiitake and enoki-take, these are called saprophytes, and they grow on dead plant material. And as soon as a tree falls or a twig falls, these are the first fungi that leap up out of the ground and gobble up that readily available nutrient source. So they're in high competition.
Wow.
It's an amazingly interesting subject because of how little we know and yet how important they are in the evolution of habitats on this planet.
So you had mentioned that your 1 foot, where if you could put just your foot on the forest floor, it would represent 300 miles of mycelium. So
That's correct.
the veins. So explain that, how these veins travel underneath the forest floor.
The mushrooms are the proverbial tip of the iceberg, and the mushroom root-like structure, which is the fine fuzzy stuff that grows in the ground, and anybody right now, well, I guess you'd need a flashlight, but if you went outside and you tipped over a piece of wood, you see these white cobwebby fine filaments, and that is mycelium. And so the mycelium is literally under every footstep that we take. In a single cubic inch of soil, there can be 1 to 8 miles of mycelium. They're very, very fine networks, but they live and they create humus in soil. And these are the grand molecular disassemblers of nature. These are decomposers, and they render dead material and break it down. And we share a more common ancestry with fungi than we do with any other kingdom. And we split from fungi about 650 million years ago. And we went the route of encirculating our nutrients with a cellular sac, a stomach. And the mycelium went the route of externally digesting its nutrients by expressing enzymes and acids, and would break down nutrients outside of its cells and then bring them in. In fact, there's a new super kingdom called Opisthokonta that joins Animalia and fungi together
Wow.
because it recognizes that we're more closely related to fungi than we are to any other kingdom. We exhale carbon dioxide, we inhale oxygen. And so these networks become quite vast. And the mushroom-forming fungi are forest fungi predominantly, and they can grow to thousands of acres in size. The largest organism in the world is a mycelial mat of a honey mushroom in eastern Oregon that's over 2,200 acres and is over 2,000 years of age, but it's only one cell wall thick.
Wow. Wow.
One cell wall thick. We have five or six skin layers that protect us from infection. The mycelium only has one. How is it capable of generating such a huge amount of mass and being directly in contact with all sorts of hungry microbes that want to eat it? Well, it's because it has a very active immune system, and we can learn from that.
They're so sophisticated, the fungi and the entire growth of it. But you had mentioned that they're in danger, that this old growth fungi is in danger. In what way?
Well, great question. As a person who was, as I was listening, we have entered into 6X, the sixth greatest extinction event. We're losing about 30,000 species per year in a genome of about 83.3 million species on this planet. Well, if you do the math, in 100 years, we'll lose more than a third of the biodiversity of the ecosystems that got us here. We have 10 to 15% of the forest debris on the ground than we did just a few hundred years ago. Now, after tens of millions of years of building up the soil humus, we are thinning the soils. And as the soils become thinner and more shallow, they have less carrying capacity. And as a result, we lose biodiversity. These fungi create soils, and about 70% of soil is microbial, and about 40% of that soil mass is fungal. And so as these fungal networks lose their ability to recycle because they're just not given enough food, we have deforested, as a result, all sorts of other species that are dependent upon the biospheres that the fungi are helping create are highly stressed. And unfortunately, they're being negatively impacted. And so much of the, you know, we are myopic in that we just live this short lifetime of 75 to 95 years. But in the context of ecosystem development, that's just a flash.
Mm-hmm.
And when you look at it in the context of a few hundred years or even a few thousand years, we are rapidly changing our ecosystems, and we're unraveling the very networks that are the basis of the food webs of life.
So that's how it's actually threatening biodiversity. So how much of these mushrooms are being harvested for things like you mentioned that you can actually clean up an oil spill with these mushrooms?
Yeah, we did some work with Battelle Laboratories and basically cleaning up Bunker C oil. This is very, very heavy, dirty oil that big tankers use in firing their boilers. And when the Exxon Valdez had a giant oil spill, that's what they spilled on the beaches and in the water. And so they approached me a few years ago, and because oyster mushrooms in particular are voracious in their ability to grow on straw and on wood, on all sorts of fabrics, it's the most aggressive of all mushroom species. We did a series of experiments. We actually surveyed about 20 different species, but that one turned out to be the best. And we were able to break down oil-saturated soil that was up by Bellingham, Washington, that had more than 20,000 parts per million, which is about 2% of the soil was oil. And in about 16 weeks, we were able to bring it down from 20,000 parts per million to less than 200. Now, this is really amazing because those oil-saturated soils are so toxic that very little biodiversity will grow upon them. And so we did four piles. One was a control, one was treated with enzymes, one was treated with bacteria, and the fourth one was treated with oyster mushroom mycelium. When, at the end of our experiment, our berm of soil became an oasis of life, this massive,
wow,
massive regeneration of plants, and the other piles were dead, dark, and neutral, and they remained at those very, very high toxic levels. And our soil was approved by the Department of Ecology for freeway landscaping. So that was a really excellent proof of concept.
It wasn't toxic. The mushrooms that formed from that mass weren't toxic.
That's a very good question. The hydrocarbons are being broken down by the enzymes of the mushroom mycelium and remanufactured into carbohydrates, into fungal sugars. And that's what the mycelium is primarily made of. About 85% of the mass of the mycelium are these complex sugars. But insofar as we did not test the heavy metals, mushrooms are known to concentrate heavy metals. So it was kind of funny because one of the workers up there saw, you know, hundreds of pounds of oyster mushrooms growing off this pile and goes, "I know what those are. I'm going to eat those." And we go, "Wait a second. You know, they are edible in terms of everything that we know, with the exception of the concentration of heavy metals." So you start to eat mushrooms along roadsides, for instance, or around a steel mill, or if there's heavy amounts of pollution.
You don't want to do that.
Yeah.
Interesting. So they absorb them and protect them, but they're not healthy to eat. And that's such a confusing thing, is which ones are healthy, which ones are poisonous, which ones are medicinal, which ones cause psychotropic effects. How do you know? Are there any qualities to tell the difference?
Well, there's no general rule, but let's make this analogy. There's about 14,000 species of mushrooms that have been identified so far, and an estimated 150,000 species that are out there that we predict. In the kingdom of fungi, about 1.5 to 2 million. But let's go back to the 14,000 species that we know of today. If you think of this 14,000 species as being like a books in a library, And over tens of thousands of years, hundreds of thousands of years, millions of years, our ancestors like would go into the Library of Nature and they would sample them. And over the eons, through trial and error, we have narrowed the field of candidates down to about 200 species that are edible, about 50 species which are medicinal. There's about 250 species that are magic mushrooms, psychoactive mushrooms. But that's how we've learned what plants are edible or poisonous, what animals are, what frogs are edible, what frogs are not edible. And we stand on the shoulders of our ancestors, and through this thread of knowledge over time, oftentimes frayed, oftentimes broken, we're rediscovering that which our ancestors knew long ago, that mushrooms are deep reservoirs of powerful medicines and very helpful foods. So, you know, it makes sense in that context, but there's a really interesting factoid that I came across, and I love to talk about it. There's 22 primates that consume mushrooms.
Hmm.
Well, 23 when you add humans, we are primates.
Mm-hmm.
but one of them in particular is really, really interesting. It's a Golgi monkey. Now, this is a very small monkey in Amazonia. It only weighs about a half of a kilogram. It eats more than 6 kilograms per year of mushrooms. It eats more than 12 times
its body weight. Yes,
12 times its body weight. Now, so it eats 6 kilograms per year. It only weighs a half a kilogram. We Americans eat about 2 kilograms. Now, if there's 22 primates, plus humans, 23, that have been known to consume mushrooms, how far back does that knowledge go? Well, I think it's pretty logical that...
Is that how you determine that 1.3 billion years and several hundred million years ago?
Well, it goes back many tens of millions of years.
Mm.
And I think there's a very interesting postulated hypothesis. I wouldn't...
Mm-hmm.
called a theory called the stoned ape theory. And Terence McKenna reiterated it from an anthropologist named Roland Fisher in the 1960s. And the stoned ape theory postulates that as the savannas increased and our primate ancestors came out of the trees, we would follow ungulates, you know, antelope and cattle and things like that. And anyone who's tracked animals, what do you look for? You look for footprints and you look for scat. Well, in the subtropics, the most common predominant large mushroom is very frequently found is a magic mushroom called Psilocybe cubensis. And the hypothesis says that as we were hunter-gatherers, tracking these animals, we would encounter these bodacious mushrooms, and then we would consume them. And that may have caused a split and a jump in the evolution of humans from our other primates. Now, this is really interesting because humans migrated from Africa into Europe about 40,000 years ago, but Neanderthals were there for 200,000 years.
Right.
But after we arrived, in less than 4,000 years, Neanderthals were extinct. So, you know, we had a more developed frontal lobe that allowed us to strategize. We could throw spears much farther, and we could carry fire. Well, that's interesting that we could carry fire because there's the Amadou mushroom that allowed for the portability of fire.
Oh, really?
And this mushroom, you can hollow it out, put embers of fire inside, and carry it for days.
Really?
Yeah. And so the ability to carry fire helped us survive. And so we are intimately connected with the relying upon the pharmacopoeia of mushrooms in nature. And they're like miniature pharmaceutical factories that are composed of all sorts of exotic molecules that can help us, that can harm us, that can heal us, and with the magic mushrooms can send us on a spiritual journey. And I don't think that hypothesis, it cannot be proven. It's an unprovable hypothesis.
But it's interesting.
Not,
I mean,
it's not illogical. It's not illogical.
But there are other things that I do want to cover that you have proved that I think are fascinating about how mycelium absorbs nuclear waste and how you've figured out how to do pest control with mycelium. So a lot of interesting things coming up when we come back. We're going to take a quick break. My guest is Paul Stamets, and he is a mycologist. We're going to continue on with more mushroom facts when we come back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast. Gotta love classic rock. Just really gets you moving. All right. Tonight we are talking with mycologist Paul Stamets, and we're talking about the incredible intelligence of the 14,000 species of mushrooms that have been around for millions of years, hundreds of millions of years. And these mushrooms, we haven't even covered the tip of the iceberg here, so to speak, but they are responsible for absorbing toxic oil spills, nuclear waste. Dr. Paul Stamets have also figured out how to use these mycelium for pest control, how to save the bees. They provide medicine for antibiotics. They even actually can boost the immune system. There are the National Institute of Health and Department of Defense showed that certain species in a class of mushrooms called polypores contain substances that were effective against human pathogens like the smallpox virus and various flu viruses. So there are many different functions of mycelium. We're learning more about that when we come back with Paul Stamets. Stick with me. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM. Welcome back to Coast AM. This is Lisa Garr. My guest is mycologist Paul Stamets. He's been doing this for over 30 years and has discovered and co-authored over 4 new species of mushrooms, probably more at this point. Paul, is that true?
Yes, it is.
How many more?
Well, right now I have 7 species under my belt, and there's a lot more that never made it to publication because I'm just too distracted with too many projects. I'm a victim of my own inventions.
Yes, speaking of inventions, let's talk about how you, well, first of all, we didn't cover the fact that mycelium absorbs nuclear waste. Now, we did cover toxic oil spills, but when it absorbs, how, in what form, and how do you, what do you put the mushroom powder in the ocean, or how does that work?
Well, it came, it really came to light after Chernobyl, when downwind, the Ukrainian scientists went out into the woods, and they were very concerned because people were foraging for wild foods. And so they started collecting all sorts of the wild plants and mushrooms. And lo and behold, they found a mushroom called the Hideous Gomphidius. It's a slimy mushroom that grows in association with trees. And it concentrated cesium-137 more than 10,000 times the background radiation levels. So this was quite remarkable because it is now known that via the mushroom mycelium from the radioactive fallout, the mycelium would up-channel the radioactive isotopes and concentrate them into the mushrooms. So the mushrooms become highly radioactive, but in the process, it decontaminated a large swath of land. And this speaks to the fact that each of these species has a skill set that we are discovering. And now, we worked with Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, and we grew another mushroom called the Garden Giant on cesium-contaminated soil. And it turns out that from those experiments, the mushrooms did not concentrate or absorb any radioactive cesium whatsoever. That cesium came from the Marshall Islands, where they blew off the hydrogen bomb. By the way, it was like about 50 times more powerful than they expected. Oops.
Wow.
These species have different abilities to absorb, and that gives us a great armamentarium, a great arsenal of using these species for different applications.
What about Fukushima?
Well, that's a very good question, because right afterwards, I wrote an article that was published, and it got widely distributed in Japan, suggesting that they evacuate, 50 miles away from that melted reactor complex, and retire it into an old-growth forest, and you'd have the nuclear forest recovery zone. It was very Japanese-esque. The Japanese liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. And then you would go over several hundred years, unfortunately. You would go in and selectively harvest the Hideous Gomphidius, which grows there, and in the process decontaminate that landscape. Right now what they're doing, they're scraping off all the soil down to rock, and it is an ongoing disaster. It has not stopped. I work with several nuclear physicists And there's no problem with people on the West Coast. I mean, you have a tremendous amount of dilution. However, when I pin down these scientists, about what's happening, and this is an ongoing disaster, they said maybe in 50 years it's going to be a real big problem elsewhere. But people should feel sorry for the people in Japan. They're the one that's really exposed right now. And
Well, could
so.
the mushrooms help? And then what happens if the mushrooms do, the mycelium do absorb the radioactive material? Do they become just radioactive mushrooms then?
Yeah.
That becomes the problem, right?
Well, but you've concentrated them and the soil's been decontaminated. So the ecosystem and the soil biota is still there. It's a major farming area. So they've been devastated. And so the idea would be you go in with hazmat suits and Geiger counters, you would locate the mushrooms that are highly radioactive and you could harvest them. Now, this is not going to be a solution in 5 years or 10 years. This is going to take several hundred years. And I like the adage that it takes one generation to pollute and 10 generations to clean it up. And we have now, pushed on to the generations to come, and just an extraordinarily complex problem with no tenable solutions.
Except the mushroom solution does sound actually like it would work, but is it being accepted? Is it being denied? What's the status of it?
Well, denial is a really good word. No, it's not. There's an enormous amount of money. It takes currently the best practices for breaking down. I couldn't believe this number, but I did check on it. It's $600,000 for a cubic meter of soil to decontaminate it. There's a lot of money in moving the soil around and storing it. These are big invoices. There is a whole industry that has developed now around Fukushima because there's so much money being spent and wasted, and those reactors are the core is still burning. It is still leaking into the ocean. It's an ongoing disaster, which is not controllable. And unfortunately, this is something that we're in new territory here, but I think it's an interesting learning lesson that we should be very careful about our technologies because the hubris of scientists and the hubris of major money is looking for short-term benefit at the expense of our long-term interests.
None of which are proven. So it's just throwing away money essentially because you're right, we won't know the effects of the solutions for a couple of hundred years.
My father was a nuclear scientist, and he worked for Babcock & Wilcox, which built nuclear reactors. And we would argue, and I would be protesting against nuclear power plants. And I was a long-haired hippie at the time. But he was in charge of nuclear waste disposal, and his thing was vitrification. If we can encase it in glass, that's the most stable way of storing it. But he said, but I remember these words haunt me to this day. He said, "No matter what, son, you never should store nuclear waste adjacent to an operating nuclear power plant. If there is a runaway reaction, then you're going to have more fuel." And well, that's exactly what happened.
Exactly what happened. My God. Well, this is, a viable solution in terms of looking into the absorption and how these mushrooms process intelligently and absorb different types of toxins. So you mentioned something about pests and how these mushrooms can actually steer harmful pests away from damaging homes and buildings in a ecological way. Can you explain a little bit about that, and have you done anything with this patent that you created?
I have 9 patents in this space, and I like to tell people it's better that I haven't than Monsanto. But
Is true.
the purpose of patents, folks, is in order to protect intellectual property so investors can have an investment and go to market. I did give away one of my patents in Australia, and it was approved for all insects. And I gave it away at a conference, and there were about 1,000 people in the conference. And I said, "Okay, folks, I'm giving this to the people of Australia." Everybody cheered. They loved it. And I go, "Okay, now which one of you is going to put your house on the line and borrow money, knowing that you have no protection to take this to market, and anyone else can beat you to this?" It's a sad reality. But patents are to reward inventors, and I'm very happy to say that I was appointed as an inventor ambassador by the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, the largest and most most prestigious scientific organization in the world. And the idea of is to communicate to the public the importance of invention and to protect scientists from being ripped off by large corporations. But how this came about was I lived in this really, really funky house. And in fact, a good friend of mine said it's the worst house he's ever seen in North America.
Nice.
It was great. It was a flat roof in Washington State where I'm in a place called Camilty Point, Washington. And it was built with Army surplus materials, flat roof, and it had 12 buckets catching rainwater when it would rain. And I had cats on the roof, so you can make your own conclusion about that. But
okay.
it was a really funky situation. When the wind would blow, the wind would slow down. But one day there was a windstorm, and the house kind of fell a few inches. And my wife said, "Oh my gosh, the house is falling down." I go, "No, dear, it's okay. The roof is no longer flat. The water will run off faster. We won't have to empty the buckets as much." She didn't think that was funny. But I was trying to, but we had ants. We had lots of carpenter ants coming into our house.
Because of the water.
Because of the water and the moisture and the mold and all that. And, you know, it was just a big super party at night with all these, with all these ants. And I went to the EPA homepage, and they were recommending this green mold fungus, which is not toxic to bees, not toxic to humans. Actually, the USDA has approved it now for use in food handling facilities, and it is called metarhizium. And so the EPA liked this because it targeted, quote-unquote, pest insects, ants and termites and mites and things like that. And so I got some cultures of this, and I have a large laboratory complex here, and we grow 20,000 kilos of mycelium per week. We
wow.
lots of mycelium, but these are spore-free environments. And so when I got the cultures, I was horrified. They were like penicillium molds. Last thing I wanted is to have spores blowing around in my laboratory. So a very strange thing happened. I was culturing it very quickly and closed up the petri dishes. The spores would fly around. And then I saw it was a green mold. Then I saw this little white wedge. And the white wedge wasn't producing any spores. So I chased it. I cultured it and moved it from one petri dish to another. And every time I did that, that white wedge got bigger. And then pretty soon there was no green mold spores at all. I was like, great. I don't have spores now to worry about. And I looked up in the scientific literature, and everyone said, oh, the strain is losing the ability to reproduce. It's not producing spores. It's dying. Avoid that. Well, I thought, well, I'm going to trick the carpenter ants, because the reason why this fungus never made it to the market, and there's a huge amount of money spent by the biopesticide industry in the 1980s, is because of spore repellency. The insects aren't stupid. And so they make bait traps for these spores of this fungus. And when the termites approached it, they'd smell, you know, a pathogen, they'd turn around and run away. And these are queen-based colonies. If you can't get to the queen, then you're just killing off little workers. And the queen's producing thousands and thousands of new workers every week. So I got my daughter's Barbie doll dish, and okay. I made a big scene. We're going to trick the carpenter ants, because I had this habit of, I make espresso in the morning, and I go vacuum up a big pile of sawdust that the carpenter ants made that night. And I do that the next day, and the next day. I mean, hundreds of days. And I'm thinking, my whole house is being consumed by carpenter ants, and it's falling down.
Wow.
What am I going to do? And so I presented on a little Barbie doll dish about 40 kernels of mycelium on rice, and I made a big scene, and we went to bed. Well, fortunately, I mean, this is how the evolution of life on this planet changed. My daughter woke up at 12:30 at night, and she was going to the bathroom, and she went over and looked down at the dish, and she couldn't believe it. It was covered with ants. And she ran into our bedroom and said, "Dad, Dusty, wake up. You won't believe this. You won't believe this." And so we were 1 o'clock in the morning. We were really tired. We go out, and we see it, and all these ants, and they're carrying the little kernels of rice back into the house. Well, 1 week later, I'm making my espresso. I go over to vacuum. There's no sawdust. And so I went, oh, my gosh, I got rid of all my carpenter ants. And so
run to the patent office. Yes.
Well, yeah. So I mentioned this to a friend of mine who's a patent attorney. And I said, I think I just overcame the spore repellency properties. And he goes, you may have found something huge.
Yes.
So now I have 9 patents. The U.S. Patent Office gave me all insects without restriction to species.
What are you doing with this?
Well, it'll cost me $10 to $50 million to commercialize this,
Oh.
because we have to do state filings and then we have to go to the federal
Testing.
filing. So it's a highly disruptive technology. There is an unfortunate newswire going around saying that Paul Stamets can take down Monsanto. I wish it was true, but it's now gone viral. It's showed up in the past 2 days, and it's gone everywhere. And indeed, this technology is a disruptive technology. And I have been told that if I can commercialize it, then I'm a huge threat. But until I can get the muster and the financial resources to be able to take it to market, we can't. But
Well, hopefully a
we're
team of
focusing.
investors is listening and you can figure that out because that's a pretty good viral tagline there.
It is, and that's why it's gone viral in a sense.
It
But
would be great if that would work. And also to do it, is that particular mold spore toxic to humans at all?
no, not at all. You can eat it.
Wow.
And we proved it against about 10 to 20 insects, fire ants, termites, carpenter ants,
And where do you get this? Do you just get it anywhere? You have to get it from a specific supplier.
Well, you can find a supplier, but it's underneath every footstep that you take. It's the most common, one of the most common, if not the most common mold in the ground. There's been a deadly dance between dinner and death between this fungus and insects over hundreds of millions of years. So that's why if you look and you see ants cleaning themselves all the time, they're cleaning themselves because they're trying to take off the spores so they don't bring the spores back to the queen. And there are these nests of termites and ants. They're factory fortresses, and they have guards at the very entrance. And if any worker that's going out brings back one of these mold spores, they'll capture that worker
Wow.
and they'll take it over to a graveyard. They'll cut off its head, and then both guards then commit suicide because they're in the graveyard with a bunch of other moldy corpses. And then two new guards
Who
that
has
are
observed
faced.
this behavior? This is
But it's because the spores are so infectious, and by delaying sporulation, the workers bring the mycelium all the way to the queen. The queen spreads it, and then woof, the whole colony then dies. And then, because of spore repellency, it prevents other termites and ants from entering that habitat. So, for
Now,
about 20 cents a house, I can get rid of. I
my
can get.
goodness.
I have the solution that can prevent termites from coming back into a house for 20 years or more.
Now, is this a fungus that comes from the mushroom?
Actually, it's a dimorphic fungus. Now, what that means, it's got a mold state and a mushroom state, and the mushroom's called cordyceps.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yeah,
Those are
and it co
healing,
and
very healing.
yeah, and so it's a beneficial mushroom to us because it helps our immune system. But in like Costa Rica and in the tropics, the ants, when they become infected with the spores, they have this impulse to climb to the very top canopy of trees, and at the very top of the canopy, they'll lock their mandible into a leaf, and boing, a mushroom springs out of their head. So it's got a mold state on the ground, and then when it's on the insect, and it causes them to climb. It's this climbing impulse. It hijacks their behavior and makes them climb, and it's kind of amusing in
And
some
turns them
sense,
into a mushroom.
unless you're an insect. But
Yeah. So, what are some of your favorite types of mushrooms, and what is their responsibility, those mushrooms?
shiitake I had tonight, and I certainly recommend that people eat shiitake mushrooms. They're very versatile. An article came out today from the University of Florida showing that 4 ounces of shiitake per day with 52 men and women after 30 days showed a massive increase in their immune function and a decrease in inflammatory responses. But the shiitake is one that I love. Maitake is another. Enoki is another. And enokitake, there's really, really thin ones with really small caps, usually white in their own big bunches. Very, very popular
In the stores, yes.
in Japanese restaurants. That one really made history
Wait, Paul.
in immunological journals
We're going to have
when
to
it.
take a quick break, Paul, but I want to find out more about that, about some of the properties of these mushrooms when we come back. We're listening to Paul Stamets talking about medicinal mushrooms and their properties. We will be right back. This is Lisa Garr. You're listening to Coast AM.